From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, gymnast and Olympian Ali Raisman speaks out about sexual abuse by the team doctor.
I am not going to stop until I get what I want, which is change. And I don't want the current generation and the next generation of athletes or, you know, kids around the world to ever have to go through this again.
Plus, Senator Ed Markey explains why he wants to strip the president of unilateral power to launch a preemptive nuclear strike.
I just think that that's an issue that goes right to the core of the separation of powers in the United States Constitution.
And we'll continue our conversation with psychoanalyst Erica Komisar, who says mothers who don't stay at home when their kids are very young may be harming their children.
How else are we going to get a paid maternity leave for mothers for at least a year if there isn't evidence that mothers are unique and biologically necessary to babies?
That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
Well, the crowd loved it with good reason. That is a performance to beat in the floor final. Ali Raisman.
Yes, that Ali Raisman, two-time Olympian, six-time medalist, USA Gymnastics team captain. That sound you just heard was from her gold medal routine in the 2012 London Games. But just 3 years before that, in 2009, Raisman says she was abused by then-team doctor Larry Nassar. Now, more than 120 people have accused Nassar of sexual abuse. Raisman has been speaking out about her experience and her gymnastics career. It's all in her new autobiography, Fierce, How Competing for Myself Changed Everything. And she joins us. Ali Raisman, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
It's a real pleasure and honor to speak
with you.
You're such a hero to so many people for your work as an Olympian and a gymnast, but now also for speaking out about sexual abuse. So I wonder if we could just kind of start with the basics.
Yeah, of course.
Because I'm thinking about the subtitle of your book, How Competing for Myself Changed Everything. Do you feel like right now that speaking out about sexual abuse is a kind of a form of competing for yourself?
I actually feel like me speaking out against sexual abuse, I'm talking about my own experience, but I feel as though because I love gymnastics so much and because I am worried, you know, for the sport, because I don't agree with the way the United States Olympic Committee and USA Gymnastics has handled everything, I actually feel like this is bigger than just me.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very, very serious problem. It's a very big problem. So I feel that I'm not going to stop until I get what I want, which is change. And I don't want the current generation and the next generation of athletes or, you know, kids around the world to ever have to go through this again.
So for folks who don't know, the team doctor for USA Gymnastics, former team doctor Larry Nassar, he's actually being sued by more than 125 people who say that he sexually assaulted them. And he's in jail right now in Michigan, we should say. That he pled guilty to possessing child pornography. But if I may ask, you write about it in the book. What happened to you specifically?
I'm not sharing the details of exactly how he sexually abused me, just because I don't feel comfortable sharing that. But I do talk a lot in the book of how he got away with it, because I want people to understand that it's not so simple as to, you know, why didn't you speak up? You know, I want people to understand that because he was a doctor, because he was a United States Olympic doctor and the USA Gymnastics doctor. So everyone around us was always saying he was the best doctor. We were so lucky to have him. And, you know, I was very young, so I didn't really know anything differently. And I trusted him. You know, you don't think that an adult or someone that is a doctor would be such a monster and such a horrific person. So I talk about that in the, there's a chapter called the Survivors chapter, and it's not any graphic detail or anything. And I did that because I want little girls to be able to read it and not be scared. I just want them to be able to read it to understand as they grow up that just because someone is nice to you, just because everyone says they're the best person, just because they give you gifts or they compliment you, it doesn't make it okay for them. In fact, it's not okay at all for them to abuse you or to hurt you. And we have to teach the younger generation these grooming techniques because I didn't know it was happening to me.
You know, it occurs to me now also that because he was a team doctor and, you know, his job ostensibly was to aid and support athletes, right? I mean, your bodies are...
Your tool.
Yeah, yeah. Right? And so I can imagine how for young people, and especially since this was allegedly happening to so many of you, that it would be confusing, right? Like, is this right? Is this wrong? It feels weird, but, you know, is this just part of what PT is?
Yeah. Well, I think it is. It's very confusing because he was on the national team for decades. And I think because he had been doing the treatment to so many people, I think a lot of us were kind of just like, well, if this is wrong, someone would have said something a while ago. Like, if he was really doing something wrong, he would have already been in jail by now. And I think what I realize now is common for people that are being abused is you make excuses for your abuser. You know, I always thought he was annoying and I thought he was weird, but I just thought that he was kind of an off person. I didn't want to ever think. You'd never want to let yourself believe. It never entered my mind that I was, you know, I was being sexually abused by someone. I mean, you think, you know, he's a doctor. You know, it's just the older that I get and the more that I'm processing it, because I still am processing it today, it's not, the abuse is not just something that happens in the moment. It affects you for the rest of your life.
So, Ali, I want to ask you a little bit more about how USA Gymnastics did respond, because you do, as you said, you write about that in the book. I mean, you write about how in, what, July of 2015, you got a call from USA Gymnastics, the then president, Steve Penny, about that a private investigator was going to come see you?
Yeah, he didn't even really, you know, I was on my way home from practice one day and he just said, I need you to do me a favor. And what people don't understand is gymnastics is not, at Olympic trials, it's not just top five girls make the team. It's however the selection committee feels. If they like you and you do well, you're on the team. But it's not totally based off your performance on just that meet. So Steve Penny's in the room while the Olympic team is being picked. So it's hard to, you don't want to say no to him. Mm-hmm. And he basically just said, you know, I need you to do this for me. You know, basically telling me I didn't really have a choice. He didn't tell me what the meeting was about, anything. I was totally caught off guard when the private investigator, Fran, came to my house. I was obviously extremely uncomfortable because as she's asking me questions about Larry, I am horrified because I'm realizing now, you know, I'm sort of saying to her that he touched me, he made me uncomfortable, but then I don't even still have words because it's horrifying, you know, going inside and I told my mom right away and we kind of started talking about it and I realized, oh my gosh, he molested me. It's a very uncomfortable and disgusting feeling. And then after that, you know, I've said and I'll say time and time again, I feel USA Gymnastics and the United States Olympic Committee did not handle it well and they're still not handling it well. And that's why I am speaking out about it.
Well, what do you think that they failed to do at that time then?
I think, you know, right from the beginning when after Fran came, you know, shortly after, you know, within the next few days, I did reach back out just saying, I'm realizing that this happened to me. I want her to come back again. I realize I did say, I made it clear he made me uncomfortable and he touched me. But I also said, I thought he didn't mean it because he gave me gifts. And so I, you know, through talking to my mom, she helped me realize and helped me kind of process it that it was happening to me. It had happened to me. And instead of them saying, you know, we are so sorry that first of all, we're so sorry this happened to you. And second of all, we're sorry that you realized it while we caught you off guard with the private investigator. What can we do to help? They did not do that at all. It was just like, please keep this quiet. You know, we're handling it. Mind
your
own business.
Don't talk about it.
Yes, I was told to keep quiet. And so that we kept, you know, within the next while months and months we kept reaching back out saying what's going on to USA Gymnastics, like, what can we, please tell us what can we do to help. And every time we were told, you know, we're handling it, you know, while USA Gymnastics, they let Larry Nassar resign. They didn't even fire him. So that he resigned and everyone was asking questions. Where is he? What's going on? They didn't explain anything to any of us. And he was also working at a gym in Michigan for a long time after. So USA Gymnastics knew he had been molesting girls, but they still allowed him to work at a gym in Michigan, which is still a USA Gymnastics gym. So they're responsible.
Well, one more question about this, because USA Gymnastics has said in a statement, quote, "We are appalled by the conduct of which Larry Nassar is accused, and we are very sorry that any athlete has been harmed during her or his gymnastics career."
They keep releasing the same, pretty much the same press release. I think they think that that's enough. I'm sick and tired of the same press release, and it's aggravating for me to. I think they think by saying that, you know, that people think that they're creating change, but they're not.
Are you not confident then that young athletes are safe inside of USA Gymnastics?
I feel there are still people working at USA Gymnastics now that looked the other way for years. So if you have the same board, you have the same people that looked the other way and allowed this monster to work on so many people for so many years, then how are we going to make sure it doesn't happen again when you have those same people there? So, no, I'm worried. I'm not. I am very concerned, and that is why. You know, there had been over the years a lot of people have come forward and said they did report things to USA Gymnastics and, you know, saying that a coach from a gym or someone had been, you know, molesting one of the gymnasts. And so maybe that coach was fired from that gym, but then he would gym hop to another state. And this kept happening. And so USA Gymnastics has to do better. I mean, how can you sleep at night knowing that these coaches are or these other people are gym hopping from one gym to another?
People are hearing this are probably thinking this sounds a lot like the Catholic Church scandal as well. But so, Ali, I have to say, I am very mindful that you, again, as I said, you're here to many people right now for speaking out about this. But first and foremost, so many people look up to you for your accomplishments.
Thank you.
As an athlete. And if we could just turn away from kind of the current issue for a moment, just talk about your career as a gymnast. Okay, so I have to say, the level at which you and your fellow Olympians are competing these days, I almost can't watch because it's so athletic and it looks so dangerous that, like, at the Olympic Games, I was watching with my hands over my
That's like all of our parents, I feel like. It's gymnastics is very scary for me. My coach jokes around I'm like the biggest chicken because it is scary. The gymnastics is just getting, like, the level is getting crazier and crazier.
How old were you when you first fell in love with it?
I think I fell in love with it right from the start. I started when I was 2 years old.
Two.
Which is so young, with mommy and me classes. And my parents put me in pretty much every single sport. And I love gymnastics. And when I was 8 years old, I just stuck with gymnastics because my schedule got so busy. But, I mean, it was my decision.
And I understand that part of your inspiration was the 96 Olympic team?
Yes. Yeah. I would watch them over and over again. I watched it when I was 8 years old. I was only 2 at the time that it aired, but we had a VHS tape, and I watched it all the time. I was obsessed with it.
When you stick a landing or you do that seventh skill to perfection, I mean, how does it feel?
When you do, I think, a really good routine at the Olympics and you know it's the best you could do, it's the best feeling in the world. You know, my coaches would always say, when you stick a landing, especially if you're at the Olympics, like, stay in your position where you salute to the judge, like, and you stick it, show that you stuck it, and stay there for a few seconds and let everyone see that you are, you know, it's kind of like the exclamation point. You feel so proud. And so I always felt like I would kind of, like, stay there and cherish the moment because it is an incredible feeling.
There's also a mental toughness, I think, that we ask of young athletes a lot that maybe we don't recognize how hard that might be. Because I was thinking about you write about in the book about when you were, what, in elementary school, sometimes kids would make fun of your muscles because you were training so hard.
Yeah, I think it's also something I've been talking about a lot. We have to teach kids to be respectful to one another because there's no reason to be mean. I mean, the boys in my class were mean to me because I think society teaches boys you have to be stronger than girls. Mm. And if you're not, then you need to be mean to them. And we have to teach boys and girls that it's okay if a girl is stronger than you. It's okay if a girl is better than you at sports. You have to be respectful to one another.
Yeah. How many more Olympics would you like to have in front of you?
I would say one. I think for a gymnast, even going to two is really I'm very, very proud of that. I feel like if I were, you know, trying to go to the next one, it would really genuinely be for myself. When I look at my gymnastics career, I feel really proud of everything I've accomplished. In gymnastics, it's hard to not compare yourself to other people constantly because the sport, that's what the sport is all yeah. about, is about who has the highest score, who has the highest place. But I learned that if I do the best I can do, and I'm genuine, I have to genuinely be proud of that.
So last question for you. We've talked about the hard work that you've put in, your love and joy for gymnastics, which I'm sure, I mean, we know thousands of other young people feel every day they're going mm-hmm. to the gym. But we also talked about the challenges mm-hmm. and your criticisms of USA Gymnastics, yeah. which is, you know, that's a goal for many of those thousands of young people.
Yeah.
What's your message to them right now, the young people who hope to be future mm-hmm. Olympians for the United States?
I would say, you know, like I said, and I'll say a million times, I love gymnastics so much, and I encourage these girls to find something that you love to do. And if it is gymnastics, then I'm going to be cheering for them all the way. I'm going to be supporting them, and I'm going to be behind them 100%. I will always be involved in the sport because I always want to make sure it is safe and they are enjoying it and they're having fun and they feel comfortable.
USA Gymnastics team captain and Olympic gold medalist Ali Raisman, her new book is Fierce, How Competing for Myself Changed Everything. It has been such a pleasure to have you to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And Ali will be speaking tonight at the Rivers School in Weston. We've got more information about that at our website, radioboston.org. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We spoke with Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey a bit earlier today. There's lots of action going on right now on the Hill. The House passed its version of the GOP tax overhaul. Not a single Democrat voted for the bill, which is estimated to add more than $1.4 trillion to the deficit over the next 10 years. And the Senate takes up the legislation next. Earlier this week, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee held a hearing on a proposal to strip the president's authority to unilaterally order a preemptive nuclear strike. Now, Senator Markey is the bill's sponsor, so I asked him why he wants Congress to have a say.
In the case of launching a nuclear war against another country, in this case, we're talking about North Korea, where North Korea has not, in fact, launched a nuclear attack against us, but taking General McMaster's words, that is the president's national security advisor's words, that it may be necessary to engage in a preventative war. If you insert the word nuclear inside of preventative nuclear war, that means that they would be considering launching nuclear weapons against the nuclear weapons of North Korea without having the United States Congress have voted upon that. And the consequences of beginning a nuclear war are so serious, so dangerous, not just for North Korea and the United States, but for South Korea, for Japan, for Guam, for the whole world, that I believe it is imperative that the United States Congress vote a declaration of nuclear war against the country if we have not been attacked with nuclear weapons.
Okay, so there's no doubt, Senator, that contemplating the use of nuclear weapons is the most serious thing that a government or a president could do. No doubt about that whatsoever. But just to be clear, is your concern right now perhaps not so much the current state of the law, but the man in the White House who may be, who has the authority right now?
I introduced the bill last October when Hillary Clinton was ahead by 7 points. I believe that this is a constitutional responsibility which must be discharged. That's why I asked Bob Corker, the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, to have the first hearing in 41 years in the House or Senate on the issue of a president's ability, authority to launch nuclear weapons, first use of nuclear weapons. I just think that that's an issue that goes right to the core of the separation of powers in the United States Constitution, and it's only exacerbated because Donald Trump is president, because he's using fire and fury. He's talking about unleashing historic devastation upon North Korea. So it takes a fundamental constitutional issue, and then it adds an urgency that Donald Trump may, in fact, right now be contemplating the use of nuclear weapons in a preventative war scenario, and all we have to do is refer over to his own National Security Advisor, General McMaster's words.
Well, Senator, in that hearing that you mentioned on Tuesday, former commander of the United States Strategic Command, retired General Robert Kaler, he testified, and he noted that there may already be certain checks and balances in the system. He said that the military could refuse to follow what it considers an illegal order. That would be an order that's disproportionate or unnecessary. I mean, did that put you at ease at all?
No, not at all. In fact, since the Strategic Air Commander is appointed by the president ultimately, because the Secretary of Defense is appointed by the president ultimately, they work for him. So there's no outside check on this process. What we actually have at this point is the exclusion of the Congress, which is supposed to be the impartial arbiter of whether or not a president can engage in military activity, and substituting a relatively homogeneous group of people, that is the people named by the president to these positions, which I don't think is an adequate check upon the use of nuclear weapons. And I think it's highly unlikely that they would exercise that authority if the president, in fact, did order the use of nuclear weapons.
Yeah. Senator Markey, I think it is good and important that American leadership have this conversation. Absolutely. I am curious about what you think sort of about the philosophy, though, behind the concept of, you know, of deterrence, because I've been seeing some folks saying if there was a prolonged approval process for the use of nuclear weapons through Congress, that could affect the United States' ability to deter adversaries with the threat of a rapid nuclear attack. So therefore, you know, maybe it's not as straightforward as one might think.
Well, that's absurd. The United States has the most powerful nuclear arsenal in the world. There's no close second. If North Korea attacks us with nuclear weapons, they should assume that North Korea will be destroyed by the end of the afternoon of the same day. They know that. So there's not a high likelihood, as a result, that they're going to actually attack us. And so that scenario is covered. The president can, in fact, respond if we have been attacked. This is a situation where we have not been attacked, where there is not an imminent threat to us, where there is just a plan which is being put in place at the White House, at the Pentagon, that would lead to a launch of a nuclear strike on another country here in North Korea. And it's my feeling, and I think most people's feeling, that President Kim is homicidal, but he's not suicidal. He knows that if he attacks the United States of America with nuclear weapons, that it's, for all intents and purposes, suicide for him and for his regime and for his country if there was a total nuclear retaliation against North Korea. So I don't think anyone has to worry that we have the capacity to respond, and Kim knows that. It's the question of whether or not we use them first, where it's unlikely he's going to be using those nuclear weapons against us.
Mm. Senator, since I've got you, there's a lot going on up on the Hill. I'd just like to ask you a couple more questions about things sort of percolating in the Senate, if I could. Because the House, of course, is voting on its version of its tax overhaul today. The Senate has made some, or Senate Republicans, I should say, have made some pretty significant changes to its version of the tax bill. All of a sudden now they're seeking to eliminate the individual mandate for health care. They would make the tax cuts temporary for middle class families, but not for corporations. I just want to get quickly your sense as to the Senate version of a tax overhaul bill.
Okay. They have two principal goals. One, destroy the Affordable Care Act. Two, return all the monies to the upper one percentile, who actually don't want to help people who need health care in America, because all of their families in the upper one percentile have no concerns about their access to the best medical care in the world.
Senator Mitch McConnell has effectively said that, right? He said it would be some $330 billion that the government would save with the health care changes, and that would go to help make the corporate tax cut permanent.
Exactly. So it's a direct income transfer from people who need health care over to people who don't need health care, and it would ensure that the wealthiest corporations and the wealthiest individuals get a tax break. So, and what it will result in is health care premiums for everyone will go up. Yeah. There'll be fewer people in the pool, and as a result, everyone else will have to pay more. So it's a pretty simple formula. The rich get richer and the poor get sicker.
Do you think, though, that the Senate's version of the bill has a chance of passing? I mean, I know that Republican Senator Ron Johnson has come out against the plan, but, you know, he also said he was opposed to the Senate's health care plan a while ago and ended up voting for it. So,
right. Well, here's the thing. He doesn't believe that the tax breaks are big enough for some of the corporations. So that seems to me to be something that they could probably work out, how to give even bigger tax breaks to the corporate subset that he is most interested in. So at the end of the day, I think he's using that as a negotiation lever. But ultimately, I think that they are going to be working with him to figure that out.
Senator Markey, one last question, because we're just seeing today an announcement that a bipartisan group of senators led by John Cornyn is going to introduce some legislation in closing gaps in reporting in the National Instant Criminal Background Check System. This has to do with a mass shooting that happened in Sutherland Springs, Texas, where, as people recall, the Air Force should have reported the shooter to the background check system because of his discharge from the Air Force, and he had a history of mental illness as well. Was never reported, so was able to purchase firearms. This, you know, looks like this bill is just going to news that it's just going to be introduced today. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, obviously, the gaps that exist in reporting of this, of the sale, the purchase of guns in our country, is absolutely glaring. And overwhelmingly, 93% of all Americans want all of the loopholes to be closed. So to the extent to which it's clear that the military wasn't complying when there were situations where those who were being discharged, you know, were being discharged because of domestic violence charges, it's across the board. And these gaps have to be closed. So I think this is a big day, where John Cornyn and Tim Scott, Republicans, can join with Chris Murphy and Richard Blumenthal from Connecticut to bridge the gap that we've had for a generation. But at the same time, we have to go further. We need an assault weapons ban. We need to ban the bump stock that was used in the massacre in Nevada.
Yeah, and that went nowhere in Congress, as we know.
So far, no. And we need the $10 million a year that I've tried each year to get in order to make it possible for there to be funding for the Centers for Disease Control to do research on the origins, the causes of gun violence in our society. But maybe this is the beginning of a new era. I'm hopeful, because thus far the NRA has had a vise-like grip on the agenda of the United States Congress. And so hopefully this is a new breakthrough day.
That was Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey. We spoke with him a bit earlier today. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Yesterday, at about exactly this time on the show, we were in the middle of a spirited conversation with psychoanalyst Erica Komisar. She's author of a controversial new book. It's called Being There: Why Prioritizing Motherhood in the First 3 Years Matters. And I'll get to why I call it controversial in just a minute. Anyway, as President Trump had actually begun to speech at the White House at this point in our conversation with Erica, the demands of the news are such that we had to switch over to the president. Well, a lot of you reacted strongly to that and didn't feel like our conversation with Erica Komisar was finished, and honestly, neither did we. So we're doing something a little unusual today. We are actually welcoming a guest back. We're welcoming Erica Komisar back, and she has graciously agreed to join us, and she does join us now from New York. Erica, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me back.
It's great to have you. It's not everyone who gets, at least on this show, who gets cut off by the president of the United States. So we felt you deserved another chance to finish this conversation. But for folks who didn't actually hear all or most of the show yesterday, I just want to explain to them a little bit about why we're having you back. And one thing I want to do is I want to say that I call your book controversial because you write in it about how, in your view, women or mothers specifically who aren't present for their children in the first 3 years of their lives, that could be harming their kids. And you point to studies about the effects that various hormones have on social and emotional regulation and that a mother's presence boosts those hormones. And then in the book, you also say that, quote, an increase in the incidence of mental illness in children is connected to the increasing disinterest in mothering in our society. So, Erica, actually, before we pick up where we left off in our conversation, I just wanted to give folks a chance to get a little more context about what we talked about yesterday. So let's listen back to a lightly edited excerpt from our discussion yesterday. And here it is. Mm-hmm. I didn't see anywhere in your book acknowledgement that the rise in these diagnoses could be for any other possible reason, that we're just diagnosing more, we have a lower societal tolerance for normal behaviors in children, maybe there's environmental stuff. I mean, I just had someone on the show not that long ago, a couple months ago, who said she firmly thought that the scientific literature said it was cell phones that are leading to this problem. So right. There's no acknowledgement of that.
So there is research in the book. You just may have missed it. So I'll ask you to go back and look at it. But there's research from Jay Belsky, who did research on children who were in more than 20 hours of non-maternal care a week in the first year, that it led to more aggression in school age years and more behavioral problems. And also the huge national study that was done on daycare was a very flawed study. But what did come out of it was that there was more signs of aggression and behavioral problems in children who spent too many hours a week in daycare. So there is research in the book. You just have to look for it.
Well, no, but I guess what I'm saying is that you are painting a very broad brush, though. I mean, you open the book talking about ADHD, talking about depression, violence, bullying, all of these things. And then you say, why is this happening to our children? And then
So the analogy that I'll use is of the three little pigs. I always use this, which is that if you build a house of bricks, meaning if you provide a foundation for that child of emotional security, it basically builds a house that can withstand the storms to come. And life is filled with storms. So, you know, if you build that house of bricks, that house is more likely to withstand the storm. If you build a house of hay or wood, meaning if you don't give your child the best chance of being emotionally secure, which we do understand is related to that moment-to-moment interaction with the mother in the first 3 years, in the first 1,000 days, you know, the child is going to be less resilient to those stressful events in their lives.
You know, you don't actually get any disagreement from me on that. I still just, I cannot make the leap from that to saying that mothers not being present is what's causing an enormous increase in mental challenges and social and emotional challenges. There's a paucity of evidence, in my opinion.
Right. So what I see in my practice and what the evidence in the research shows is that there's something called hypervigilance, meaning remember mothers buffer children from stress. So when you don't buffer a child from stress, the parts of their brain, there's a little part of the brain called the amygdala, which is like the warning system of the brain.
It's one of the most primitive parts of the brain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. It's a little almond-shaped part of the brain, but it's basically the warning system of the brain that basically tells us we're in a stressful situation and we're under stress. And think of it, if a child doesn't have that buffering from the mother, that alarm system goes off and stays like a light switch getting stuck in the on position, which leads to what we call hypervigilance. And in hypervigilance, we see children will either become extremely active, almost distractibly active, or will become very aggressive. And those are the symptoms that we're seeing in very young children when they don't have that stress buffering and that emotional regulation.
So you are talking about the primacy of the maternal bond.
Well, I think mothers are unique, and I'm not ashamed to say that.
Well, that was from yesterday in our conversation with Erica Komisar. She's author of the book Being There, Why Prioritizing Motherhood in the First 3 Years Matters. And again, Erica's agreed to join us again today so we can pick up where we left off. Erica, thank you again for joining us.
You're welcome.
So let's just pick up where we left off about the primacy of the maternal bond, because I know one thing that I wanted to discuss with you in greater detail yesterday was, so what does that mean in families where a father's a primary caregiver, or adoptive families, or same-sex couples?
Mm-hmm. Well, we know that there's a diversity of family structures now, and we know that fathers are staying home as primary caregivers. And so what I say in the book and what I really believe is that even though mothers are unique, we can teach fathers to be more like mothers. But first, we have to recognize that there's a difference. If we don't recognize the difference and that mothers and fathers are not interchangeable and exactly the same in terms of nurturing, then we have no chance of educating fathers how to be different. But yes, fathers can be taught, if they're open, to being more like sensitive, empathic nurturers like mothers.
Hmm. And then what about for families where there's, you know, same-sex couples and maybe there's adoptive families.
Well, can
families.
I answer that?
Actually, I'm going to start with adoptive families or foster families, because I am curious about your take is on mothers who aren't the biological mother.
Sure. So in terms of mothers who aren't biological, when somebody hands you a baby and that baby becomes yours and your investment in that baby is the same as a biological mother's investment, the research shows that you can produce oxytocin in the same quantities as a mother who biologically gave birth. There's even been research to show that mothers who didn't give birth could even lactate and produce breast milk. So mothers being unique, meaning something about our female hormones interact. You know, prolactin is connected to estrogen, is connected to oxytocin. So, you know, yes. So the answer is an adoptive mother who gets bonded and attached to the baby, because that's the key, can produce a lot of the same oxytocin hormones in the brain. But can I answer the question that you asked about a gay couple?
Sure, absolutely, please.
Basically, when and I have a practice in New York, so I see a number of gay couples. Two men who are raising children and two women. And, you know, when a couple comes in who are two gay men, first thing I'll say is, which one of you is the mother? And what I'm essentially saying is, which one of you is going to play that role of being sensitive, empathic nurturer, and is going to be the primary caregiver? And I teach that partner to be more like a mother.
Well, listeners, what do you think about Erica Komisar's argument, her book, in which she states that women who choose not to be present, in her terms, for their child's first 3 years of life may be harming their children in the long run? And how do you think we're going to do a better job helping women, families, primary caregivers be present? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We had a lot of callers waiting on the line yesterday who we couldn't get to. So let's hear from some of them now. Amy is calling from Salem. You're on the air, Amy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I did listen to the program yesterday, and I have to say that first I laughed and then I kind of sobbed. I think that using the kind of scientific studies that you're talking about, they can give us generalizations about men and women, and they can tell us that on average, women, you know, mothers may be more sensitive and empathic nurturers than men. But that's like saying that on average, women have, you know, men have more upper body strength than women do. That's true on average, but it also is completely compatible with the fact that there are millions of women out there who have more upper body strength than millions of men do. And, you know, I grew up with a mother who was home and who was, you know, who had zero ability to be a sensitive and empathic nurturer. I mean, I love her and she did her best and she had us in clean clothes and had a, you know, nutritious dinner on the table every night, but sensitive, empathic nurturer is just not who she was.
Yeah.
And my father, on the other hand, was someone who was much more capable of emotional sensitivity and, you know, the kind of emotional nurturing that I agree that babies need. So it makes me very sad that after all these years of the women's movement, we're still essentializing about women versus men. I mean, women,
Amy, can I just jump in here?
Because individual profiles.
Because I take your point, and especially your point about the women's movement, because Erica, you know, in your book, you do write about that. Other people have reacted similarly to what you're writing and what you're saying.
Mm-hmm. And you know what I say in my book? I mean, if you read the book really says that you have to be emotionally and physically present, and that a mother who's physically present but emotionally checked out is no more present than a mother who's checked out physically as well. And it really is about emotional and physical presence. And yes, some women are, as we say, many women are postpartumly depressed or, you know, not healthily attached mothers. And, you know, we're talking about a healthy mother and a mother who is attached and has bonded and is a sensitive empathic nurturer.
So, I mean, what's the ideal situation, though? Because I'm trying to put my mind in terms, I'm trying to imagine what the perfect sort of a household would be then in your mind, because mm-hmm. for any parent to be 100% present for their children, mm-hmm. Is really hard.
Yeah. And I also say in the book, there's no perfect. And you can't be present every single moment. So again, there's an entire chapter on repair. And repair means even if you are distracted for a moment, you're repairing things when you look back at your baby. I mean, babies have this incredible thing that they do, which is they use very primitive defenses. If their mother is distracted or if their mother is having an anxious moment or, you know, babies will, in that moment, look away to protect themselves. They'll dissociate. And then they'll come back to the mother when the mother's calmer and when the baby can come back to the mother. And so, you know, in a way, we're not talking about mothers being perfect. We're not talking about being able to be present every single moment. But when you're absent, even if it's for a moment, you're turning back to the baby and reconnecting and repairing the absence. And so there's a lot of nuance to this book, and there's a whole chapter on repair, whether you're away for 8 hours or whether you're away for 5 minutes going to the bathroom.
Let's take another call. Jeff is calling from Brighton. You're on the air, Jeff.
Yeah, hi. So I'm a stay-at-home dad for my... And I guess, I don't know. I mean, I take issue with a couple of things. First is I feel like there's so much judgment already wrapped up in moms who choose to go to work and, you know, dads who choose to stay home that I'm not really sure we need to add another book to the canon of what's wrong with working moms. But also, I don't know. I mean, I feel like I take issue with the idea that I need to be, you know, more like a mother. I think what I need to do is love my kids, which I do, and show them that, which I do, and, you know, make sure that we have a lot of fun and, you know, secure bonds and that they're safe. And I'm not really sure that that is a female or a male thing. I think that's a parent thing.
Jeff, thanks for your call. Erica, your response to that?
Yeah, sure. So, Jeff, are you the primary caregiver?
You couldn't hear at the beginning of his cell phone line, but he said he's a stay-at-home dad. Yeah.
Okay, got it. So, you know, if you're the primary caregiver, it is more important that you're the sensitive, empathic nurturer. And if you are not the primary caregiver, then being a dad is wonderful. And as I said yesterday, dads are critical to children as well. In fact, the studies about dads not being present enough, which are very recent studies, show that little boys in particular, psyches, are so sensitive to father's absence that when fathers aren't present enough, little boys don't develop the ability to regulate their aggression. And so, yeah, fathers are critical too. I just don't believe that they're interchangeable with mothers.
Dana is calling from Cambridge. You're on the air, Dana.
Hi, Magna. Thanks. All this talk about the importance of mothers as a mother of two young boys should be making me feel really good about my role as a mother. And yet I can't help but experience what you spoke about yesterday is a sort of sense of shame that because I'm a working mother out of necessity, I'm setting my kids up for future failure. And there's nothing, you know, there's no way around that. And I hear the words like choose to be out of the home. Or checking out. I don't choose to be out of the home, and I don't check out. It's an uphill battle, and it's a necessity for a lot of families. and it's just, it's almost heartbreaking.
Yeah. So Dana, thank you so much for your call. Erica, I'd like to underscore something that I heard in Dana's voice, maybe not exactly in her words, but every person I have ever spoke to who has to make the decision about when and where, and I'm going to speak about work specifically, to return to work after the birth of a child, that is an agonizing decision. And I have to say, in your book, there were a couple of places in which I thought you were being somewhat judgmental by saying people are choosing their exterior lives or their personal lives over the new life that they have brought into this world. And I don't think anybody actively says, I prefer to spend 10 hours a day at the office over being with my child. It does seem a little judgmental.
So I'm going to disagree with you that there are many women who have to work, and then there are many women today who prefer to work because they would be bored staying home with their babies. And in fact, I just wrote an article about how boredom, moments of boredom, are natural and normal in all jobs that you do, in all relationships. But a pervasive feeling of boredom is usually a sign of postpartum depression in women. So, yes, there are many, many women who have to work. And again, there's a lot of information in the book for those working women on how to be as present as possible, even though they work. And, you know, it's never a one-to-one correlation between, not being there enough and having a child who's mentally ill. In fact, there are studies to show that many children are being born more sensitive than we ever have understood before. And that if you have a sensitive child who's basically born genetically sensitive with something called a short allele on the serotonin receptor, those children are even more susceptible to anxiety and depression and mental disorders. And what the research shows is that a maternal sensitive empathic nurturing neutralizes the expression of that gene. So those children have as great a chance of being mentally healthy as ones born without that gene. And what we know is that a lot of babies are born sensitive. So if you don't have a sensitive baby and you're not there as much, and you have a surrogate caregiver who's good enough, then your baby might be fine. But if you have a sensitive child, they may be more impacted.
Okay, so just for a point of clarification here briefly, because did I hear you say a minute or two ago that there is no correlation between a mother's presence and mental illness later in life? Because in your book,
I said there is no one-to-one correlation, meaning what I see in my practice and what the research shows is that the ability to regulate one's emotions and the ability to be resilient to stress is developed in the first 3 years through the interaction in the presence of a sensitive, empathic mother. Now, does that mean that all babies who don't have that will develop into, you know, having mental disorders? Of course, no one can say that, but that is what I'm seeing in my practice, and that is what the research shows.
So just again, my perspective is what you're seeing in your practice is anecdotal and not at all equivalent to what an actual longitudinal scientific study might show.
Well, actually, the longitudinal study that Kaiser Permanente did showed that neglect and abuse in early childhood really became mental illness in adulthood. And that
But neglect and abuse are different, are in a different sphere than what you describe as not being present.
No, because the kind of absence that I'm talking about is painful to a baby.
So am I abusing my 3-year-old by being here talking to you and not being at home with him?
It depends on how sensitive that baby is. It depends on how you repair that absence when you come home. So, again, the book is meant to help all women, women who have to work, women who do work, women who stay at home. And it's really meant for all women. It's not just meant for one type of woman. It's meant for all women.
Well, I want to sneak in one more call here, if we can, because, again, the lines have lit up. That's the right English. Mm-hmm. Sorry about that. Linda is calling from Chelmsford. Linda, we just got a couple seconds, so go for it.
Okay, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say that I stayed home with my children. It was a choice that I could make. It was a sacrifice, but I did it, and I wish everybody could do it. I taught middle school for a number of years, and at the end of the year, I would try and experiment every year. I would try to pick out the kids that I thought went to daycare and the kids that I thought didn't. And then I would ask for a show of hands, and almost always, I was right on the money.
Linda, thank you so much for your call. Erica, one last question for you. We've got a minute and a half to go. You know, I feel like you present a lot of interesting studies and evidence about the biological connection between a mother and her child. I don't take issue with that. And I also, of course, we didn't talk about this enough, but I absolutely do not take issue with your prescription for how we assist all families, right? 1 year of paid maternity leave to begin with. I think the challenge is that it's that middle ground when you're talking about people choosing or not choosing to be at home or be present, that you risk alienating a lot of folks, whereas you do have sort of a bookend of ideas that could be attractive to people across the political spectrum here. That's kind of how I see what the book contains.
Yeah. So what I believe in is a child-centric society, that we, yes, of course, our needs as women and as men, as mothers, as fathers are important. But, you know, my belief is that you don't have to have children to have a happy life or a satisfying life. And that is what the feminist movement taught us, that we have choices. But that if you are going to have a child, you have a sacred obligation to be as emotionally and physically present to meet that child's needs as possible, to give that child the greatest chance that you can of being mentally healthy and emotionally well. That is what I believe.
Well, Erica Komisar, the new book is Being There, Why Prioritizing Motherhood in the First 3 Years Matters. Thank you so much for giving 2 days of your time to us.
Thank you for having me.
I really appreciate it. And you got us thinking about a lot of stuff, a lot of reactions. So thank you again.
Thank you.
This is Radio Boston.